pull out your outlines from your worship guides and open up to Genesis chapter 41. Genesis chapter 41. If you're a guest with us this morning, perhaps you did not bring a Bible. We have provided some for you in the book rack right in front of you. First book of the Bible is the book of Genesis. If you'll open up to chapter 41, we will be starting right there. Genesis chapter 41. Sometimes the problems of the world are a little overwhelming to me. They leave me feeling helpless and hopeless. Just in the last couple of weeks, I've mentioned before the shootings that have gone on at the high school out in Bailey, Colorado. The young Amish girls that were shot to death in Pennsylvania. I have watched the news over the past several weeks, and I see that the situation in Iraq for the United States continues to go downhill. The country sinks deeper and deeper into a civil war. And our troops, some of which are families that are connected to people that are right here in our church family, are in the crossfire of what is going on in Iraq. We continue to hunt for Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, and we continue to come up empty in finding him. Terrorism scares everyone. How many of us this last week, when Corey Lytle's plane tragically smashed into the side of another high-rise in New York, didn't think, is it another terrorist attack? How much more the people that lived through it in New York? Families are torn to shreds, and it's right there on the front of CNN. The nuclear threat in North Korea, which has become so prominent. Yesterday, North Korea said that if there's any more pressure from the United States, they'll consider it a declaration of war. What in the world is going on? It makes me just feel like, man, this is so overwhelming. There's so much. It's not just like one situation. It's a thousand situations. And because of the world we live in, because of the internet and television and satellites, all of it is beamed right into our living rooms. All of it is beamed right into our computers. And so we're more aware of what is happening around the world than ever before. And it leaves me feeling a little bit helpless. I kind of feel like, hey, I'm only one guy. Even our church, I feel like, you know, gosh, we're only one church in a world that is going absolutely crazy. What are we supposed to do? I'm sure as we approach Genesis 41 that it was thoughts like these that were running through Joseph's head. I mean, here's this guy kidnapped from his own country and dragged down and sold into slavery in Egypt. He ends up in Potiphar's house and has a pretty sweet situation. And then Potiphar's wife goes crazy on him. And he ends up being thrown in jail. Where he's literally just left to rot. Left to live out the rest of his days. Even when he gets into influential relationships like he did with the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. One of them ends up dead and the other one ends up ignoring him. Forgetting that Joseph is even alive. I can imagine that as Joseph sat in jail, serving in the very household that he betrayed him, that he felt pretty overwhelmed. He felt pretty emptied out. What difference can I make? What difference am I ever going to have in this world? Is this what God called me to? Is this what God has for me? I'm just going to sit in a jail cell and rot? What will happen with my life? I think it's a question that all of us should probably ask ourselves. Is where you're at right now the pinnacle of what God has for you? Are you at the high point? Are you at the top of Mount Everest, looking down on the rest of your life? I certainly hope not. I certainly hope that God has more for you, as He did for Joseph. See, I think Joseph could have been hopeless. But the greatest message in all of this story is that while everything and everyone abandons Joseph, God did not. And so as we pick it up, in Genesis chapter 41, the story gets kind of interesting. It says, now it happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. This is 2 years after the birthday where Joseph had interpreted the dreams for the chief cupbearer and the baker. And behold, in Pharaoh's dream, he was standing by the Nile. Now it's important to know that the Nile River in Egypt was literally the main artery for everything that happened in the country. The Nile was the part of their world that provided them with all of their power, all of their wealth, because of the agriculture that came from the Nile. The Nile would flood seasonally, and in the plains that when the water went back into the normal banks of the Nile, the areas that had flooded were left rich with soil. And the Egyptians would plant in that soil, and they would reap crops. It was literally a land of milk and honey in the ancient world. Egypt, because of the Nile River, had literally one of the wealthiest incomes, one of the wealthiest gross national products that existed of any country. And we can see it, can't we? Still to this day. We see the pyramids. We see the wealth that was in those tombs of the Egyptian kings. And it was unparalleled in that time period. Egypt was an intensely wealthy country, and one of the main reasons that they were that wealthy was the Nile River. So, if you would have read this, being from that culture, and you would have read that Pharaoh had a dream and he was standing by the Nile, he was literally standing by the very river, standing by the very thing that brought Egypt all of its power. The Nile was like the arm of the country, flexing its power. And out of the Nile came great wealth. And lo, from the Nile there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed in the marsh grass. This would have given Pharaoh a satisfied feeling. Look at these cows, sleek, big, fat heifer cows that were fattened off of the marsh grass that came from the Nile. This would have been fully appropriate, but his dream continues. It's not just the set of cows that are good. There's 7 grotesque cows that come. The dream is so grotesque, letter B, and so disturbing that Pharaoh actually is startled awake, as though he has been having a nightmare. See those grotesque cows with their rib cages showing? Those grotesque cows that were limping along eat the fat cows. And like a nightmare that you or I might have, he is startled awake. He rolls over in bed. He sits up and he's like, oh, just a dream. Just, okay, I'm going to go back to sleep. You ever had one of those? My wife is a very vivid dreamer. She has dreams, and the evil person in all of her dreams is me. I don't know why this is. It just is. And so, in past history, I must admit, it's getting better. But in past history, one night I woke up and Melinda thought that I was an intruder in the house. And I was being beaten to death by my wife, who was just dreaming. Boom, 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 boom. I'm getting belted and hit. And I'm like, what? What are you doing? So I grab her and I pin her down and she's dreaming. So she thinks, I'm being assaulted. And so she's freaking out and yelling at me and everything. And then I wake her up and I'm like, honey, it's just a dream. It's just a dream. And she's like, oh. She's out! Gone! I'm sitting there in bed. Pharaoh has a bad dream. He wakes up all startled and he, boom, just right back to sleep again. And as is true, you probably know this, that when you fall back to sleep and you're in that sleep, begins to have another dream. After his spirit is settled, he falls back to sleep. He has a second dream, this time about 2 sets of 7 ears of corn. The second dream is equally grotesque. It's equally shocking. And it awakens Pharaoh again from his nightmare. He wakes up and he's thinking everything that is good is being consumed by everything that is bad. But like the baker and the chief cupbearer, Pharaoh has a problem. Pharaoh interprets that the gods are trying to tell me something. You remember that the Egyptian culture believed that when they dreamed, they were entering into the land of where the dead and the gods reigned. And so he feels that this is a message from God to him as leader of the country, as king of Egypt, as the Pharaoh, but he can't figure out what God is trying to say to him. And so Pharaoh, with this diagnosis, he knows that he's been given a message, with no prognosis, begins to do what the chief cupbearer and the baker could not. See, Pharaoh was the most powerful man in the land. The people in Egypt believed that the pharaohs were gods, that they were literally gods in the flesh, and they were worshipped as such. People bowed down to them. People paid them money, not like taxes, but out of worship to the pharaohs. That's why the pharaohs had such unbelievable and extraordinary wealth. That's why they were able to build monuments that last all the way to this day. You'll remember, we're looking at a story that is probably in the ballpark of 3,500 years old. And from that time period to today, the monuments that were built to these men still stand. You can today go to Egypt and see the tombs and see the pyramids and see the wealth in the museums and out on the countryside. Pharaoh was an influential man, and so because he is so troubled, he calls all. Note that it says that in the text in verse 8. Because he was so troubled, he sent and called for all of the magicians of Egypt. Now don't be distracted by that word magicians. That was the best science of the day that they had. Essentially, he called all the scientists and all the philosophers of the empire to himself. He wanted them to interpret the dream, so he gives it to them. 7 fat cows, 7 lean cows, 7 fat corns, 7 lean corns. Eat this. What do you think? And nobody can help Pharaoh understand the message. Of all the wisdom of Egypt, of all the science, of all the philosophy, of all the people that come to interpret the dream, no one can help Pharaoh understand. Of course, who is standing by? Who is standing next to the throne of Pharaoh? Anytime Pharaoh needed a drink, that drink had to come through who? The chief cupbearer. The chief cupbearer who had been imprisoned with Joseph. See, the cup had to go through the chief cupbearer. He would sip it. If he didn't keel over from poison, he would hand it to Pharaoh. That he was in a trusted position. And so the chief cupbearer leans down. Because of his position, he would have seen all this playing out in front of him. And he remembers this long-forgotten episode in his life. This episode from a couple years ago about that Hebrew guy back in Potiphar's jail, that guy named Joseph. And so he relates the story. He reminds Pharaoh, remember when you were so angry with me? Remember when you threw me in jail? There was a Hebrew youth who was serving Potiphar. And that Hebrew youth that was in Potiphar's jail, he accurately interpreted my dream, not only my dream, but the dream of the chief baker. And he told the chief baker that he was going to die, and he told me I was going to be reinstituted. Well, Pharaoh, you know the rest of the story. You did kill the chief baker. Remember, you took his head off. You hung him. And here I am. I think that Hebrew youth could probably help you out. Would you like me to go get him? Suddenly, when all is lost for Joseph, when Joseph is set in the midst of his hopelessness, when Joseph is stuck in the pit, in the hole of the jail that he is in, suddenly, without any warning, God begins to work. And God calls out to Joseph, and he sends him not back to Potiphar, not to another influential family in Egypt, not to somebody that's low down on the food chain. He sends him to the Pharaoh, the king of all the land, the most influential man in Egypt, the man in Egypt that was literally considered a god by the people. I think that underlying some of the tone in the cupbearer's voice is a sense of racism. I think that the cupbearer probably ignored Joseph because he was a Hebrew. He had a certain amount of disdain. He even selects the word that would be kind of pejorative for a Hebrew youth in verse 12. You can see that God specifically chose the cupbearer because it is almost predetermined that the cupbearer won't say anything unless he absolutely has to. And when he goes to Pharaoh, he says, yeah, this Hebrew, not a pleasant name in that culture. Those of you that have read ahead, in chapter 46, it says that the Egyptians hated shepherds. They hated people that went out and worked with livestock. They thought that it was a disgusting job. Well, guess what Hebrews do? That's what they do. They're shepherds. They live out on the land. They're kind of a nomadic people, and they take their flocks with them. And so the Hebrews were treated poorly by Egyptians. And God uses that poor treatment of Joseph by the cupbearer, and He uses it for the advantage. He waits until the time is ripe. He gives Pharaoh a dream that no one can interpret, to where the only person in all of Egypt that is connected at all to that throne room is who? Joseph. Would Joseph have known any of this? No. He would have known nothing. He would have known nothing of how this would play out. All he knew is what? He had been forgotten. He had been rejected. He had been left. Perhaps this morning this is how you feel? That God is at a distance? That God does not care? That God does not see? That God does not observe your life? That God has abandoned you and left you alone? That you can do what you want because God doesn't care? He's got bigger things on His mind. He's probably worried about North Korea. And this passage reveals with great clarity that God is at work in our lives in the insignificant, seemingly unimportant moments, in the things that seem to matter none to you and I, that God is at work. And that what He was seeking from Joseph was to remain faithful. See, he had given Joseph a dream of his own family bowing down to him, a vision of what the future was going to be like, and that dream was unfulfilled. And even though Joseph saw other dreams being fulfilled right in front of his eyes, Joseph had his dream that was still left unfulfilled. And I know what that feels like. I think a lot of us know what that feels like. To know that God is going to do something great with your life. And I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know what it's going to be in you. I don't know what it's going to be in our church. I don't know what it's going to be in me. But are you living in a way that says, I anticipate, God, what You are going to do in my life? That's how Joseph lived. He lived faithfully despite the circumstances. And so, Joseph is once again pulled out of the pit. You remember that his brothers threw him down in the pit. The word in Hebrew that is used is literally pit or a hole. They throw him down in the hole, and then what do his brothers do? They pull him out of the pit and they sell him to traders. So he kind of goes out of the pit and into the slavery business. And so he gets given to Potiphar and he gets raised up real high in the Egyptian kingdom. He's living large, but then Potiphar's wife goes crazy. And it throws him into jail. The word for jail that is used, Potiphar's jail, literally, Potiphar's hole, Potiphar's pit. And so now, it says that he sends for Joseph. Who do you think would go and get someone for the Pharaoh out of Potiphar's jail? Probably Potiphar. Imagine that. Imagine the redemption in that. Imagine the moment that Joseph is sitting there, gross, unshaven. I mean, he's in jail, you know. He's looking probably pretty shabby. And in walks Potiphar, the very man that threw him down into this hole. And Potiphar says, we need to get you cleaned up. Pharaoh himself wants to see you. And so it says in the text that they get Joseph, and he is immediately Egyptianized. He is cleaned up. You don't go to see the President of the United States wearing torn jeans and flip-flops. When you go to see the President of the United States, you dress appropriately. You dress in a way that conveys respect to the one that you are meeting. And the same was true in this culture for meeting Pharaoh. He was Egyptianized. He was dressed and shaved in such a way that he was prepared for presentation to Pharaoh. As he is prepared, in verse 14, you can imagine what's going on in his mind. Imagine the powerful transition that is happening in his life. He goes from prison to the palace. From a place where men have no hope to the halls of power, where a single man was worshipped as a god. into this spectacle, let her see, Joseph is placed in front of Pharaoh. Pharaoh tells Joseph, hey, I've heard about your dream interpreting ability. I've heard about what you can do. And he asks him if he can interpret his own dream in verse 15. And look at Joseph's response in verse 16. Joseph then answered Pharaoh and says, it is not in me. In Hebrew, that is one word. It would be like crying out, no, wait a minute. No, stop right there. Can you imagine if you were brought in front of a very powerful person? A person that held life and death, in your life and death, I mean, in the palm of his hand. And he said, you know, I've heard that you can interpret dreams. Something that you've done in the past. I mean, God's been giving you dreams ever since you were a teenager at least. And you've been able to interpret the dreams of others. You've got a fair amount of confidence that this is one of the things that God put you on the earth to do. And somebody comes to you, somebody that could literally solve the problem that you've got, whatever it is, financial, slavery, whatever. I mean, Joseph's problems could be solved through this man. And the first things off of his lips is, I hear that you can interpret dreams. And what's Joseph's response? No! Seems opposite, doesn't it? Seems opposite of what perhaps you and I might cry out in front of a highly influential figure. Someone that could just turn and say, why'd you bring this guy to me? Kill him. Joseph says, no. It's not me. I'm not the one. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. And by favorable, he isn't really interpreting whether it will be a good dream or a bad dream, but he's just saying, God will give you a favorable answer. God will give you an interpretation that is favorable or accurate. It will be right. It will be good. In the sense that it is accurate to what you have dreamed. Rather than take any credit, Joseph makes clear that God is the one who could give Pharaoh an interpretation. See, the people of the land, letter B, may have thought that Pharaoh was a god, but there were two men in that room that knew better. Joseph and Pharaoh. Pharaoh knew he wasn't a god. And Joseph knew that Pharaoh was not a god. And so Joseph clarifies, Pharaoh, you know you're not a god, and I know you're not a god, but God, He can provide you with what you need. I think there's a lesson in here for us, not one that I can camp on for very long. There's a lesson about government in here, that governments serve God's purposes in this world. They hold no special influence that should intimidate. There is no reason to fear government or the people that are elected to government. What did Jesus Christ say to Pilate? You're only in your position because God allows it. Because God puts you there. All the purposes of government will eventually glorify God. And we get real troubled in our culture about all that is going on with our government and the governments around the world. And Joseph shows us the face of a man who stands right in front of the most powerful person that was in his world. And does he kowtow to Him? Does He bow down to Him? Does He give up on His faith in God in the face of this powerful man? No. He pretty much says, hey, if you want your interpretation, then you will have to recognize that it comes from God, not from me. Governments go only to serve God's purposes in this world. Joseph was clear on that. And Pharaoh understood it too, because without argument or hesitation, he dramatically, and by the way, you can see this in the text even, the word behold, or in some of your literal translations, the word that is used is lo. You've heard that phrase, lo, whatever, lo I am with you always. That's the word behold. It's the same exact word in Hebrew, and it is one of exclamation. It is one of saying, look at this. It's a word of intensity. It's a word of like grabbing you by the lapel and pulling you in close and saying, listen, look. Look at what happened. And so, Pharaoh, with all of these dramatic behold and lo statements, describes the content of his dreams to Joseph. The dreams that Pharaoh describes are more dramatic than the original account. The cows have become much more grotesque, much more filthy, much more disgusting. The corn is more withered. It is more intense than the original account. And with the same calm confidence that he displayed with the cupbearer and the baker, Joseph delivers the meaning. What is the meaning? What is the meaning of these crazy dreams that Pharaoh's been having? I love how it starts. I love how he starts with the very thing that would have confounded all of the scientists, all the philosophers, and all the magicians. He says, Pharaoh, your dreams that you've been having are one in the same. You can just imagine being one of those people that's been racking their brains trying to figure out what's going on. And they're like, what? One's about a cow. One's about corn. What's he talking about? One and the same. See, a lot of you know the interpretation. So you're like, oh, it's obvious, plain as day. You know, not so much to them. That revelation was only provided to Joseph. And he reveals 7 years, letter E of abundance, followed by 7 years of famine. Further, Joseph assures Pharaoh that God will do what he has revealed. Why? Because he gave him two dreams that were the same. What does that remind you of? It reminds you of some of the documents. It may not remind you of this. It reminds me of this. It reminds us of some of the documents that have been found of the dreamology of the Egyptian culture. They said if you ever have two dreams that are identical to one another, then it is assurance from the gods that it will come true. I think it's a great example of how God is working in union with people. He reveals Himself within the context that people come from. God does not expect us to rise up to His level of understanding. God stoops down and reveals Himself within our context of understanding, which is good news for stupid people like me and like you. God has bent down. He has revealed Himself to us. It seems so crazy that some of us talk about accepting Jesus as though we climbed the hill of Jesus and found Him there. It seems so ridiculous that we talk about God as though we have acquired Him or apprehended Him. God has condescended to our level by sending us His Son in all humility so that we could understand God in the flesh. And we see God doing the same thing right here in Egypt, reaching down to these people and saying, here, I'll make it easy for you. I'm going to give you stuff that you understand. Joseph relays, and this is what is so unbelievable, after the interpretation, like, you know, a dream interpreter should have stopped right there. But what does Joseph do? Oh, and I've got some advice for you. I mean, this guy's got guts. God's given him a message, and he's not going to shut up till it's all out. He's not going to stop until he's gotten it all out to this guy. And so he's like, okay, there's your interpretation, but now I've got some advice. And God, top of the next page, number 5, letter A, speaking through Joseph, tells Pharaoh that, Pharaoh, you should seek a wise man who can be set over the whole land of Egypt. We see here Joseph's faithfulness to the message, as we talked about last week. He was faithful, even to giving advice to Pharaoh. He was in jail a few hours earlier. And now he's standing in front of Pharaoh. Not only has he interpreted his dream, he's kind of shuttling up next to him and saying, hey, you know what you need to do? You need to find someone who's really wise, who can oversee this enormous project. And here's the idea. Joseph goes on, letter B, to present God's plan for saving 20% of all the food in all of the land of Egypt. Because there are going to be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of devastating famine. He says, save 20% during those first 7 years. Tax all the people, 20% of everything that they, you know, generate from the powerful Nile River should be brought into these storehouses. And then when we hit 7 years of famine, when the Nile just kind of shrinks down to nothing and we can't produce any crops, then that 20% will carry us for those 7 years. The food was to be stored in cities too, not just in one location, but in several storage cities for distribution later. And how does Joseph couch it? This will preserve the kingdom of Egypt. This will preserve your empire, Pharaoh. What do we know from later on in the story? It's not just Pharaoh's empire that's going to be preserved. But it's God's chosen people. God will give one country plenty in order to benefit God's people in some other location. I love that because I think of the Chile team. I think of what we are doing. God has given us great benefit. I've said 1,000 times probably. We are the richest country in all of history, of all time. You know, in all human history, we are the richest country ever. And we, in Southern California, live in one of the wealthiest areas of the richest country in all of history ever. You are some of the richest people in all of history. And I know you feel that way. I know, like me, I sit on the throne of my house. You know, I sit in my grand living room. And, right? I mean, we don't feel very wealthy. But God has given us abundance so that we can reach into other kingdoms, into other worlds, into other countries, and we can send the gospel message of what God is doing. God has blessed the United States of America, not as God's country. All governments serve the purposes of the Lord. God has blessed His people in this place in order to allow us to send great amounts of money, great support for all the missionaries, not only in Chile, but for all of the missionaries that we're connected to through the Great Commission Fund and the Christian Missionary Alliance. This is what God has given us as a task to do. He has blessed us. And we see God's missional attitude in what is said to Pharaoh. Your kingdom will be preserved. But we know that in the preservation of Egypt, God's chosen people would be preserved also. We know, because we've read the rest of the story, that great things are going to happen to Joseph personally and to all of Israel because of what God is doing in Egypt. Well, Pharaoh likes, letter D, Joseph's bold proposal. He called all the magicians, the scientists, the wise men, the scholars in Egypt, but nobody could give him any help. But Joseph, who was a prisoner, a foreigner, he was hopeless. He could probably look around his life situation and get overwhelmed. Like the Amish kids, like North Korea, like the war in Iraq. The situation that you face in your own world that just overwhelms you. And I don't know what it is. It'd be foolish for me to try. But the thing that keeps you up at night, the thing that haunts your heart, is God the God of that too? Is God as big as that issue in your life? See, the message here is that God is that big, that God is involved in your life, that God has determined to be at work in you. See, Joseph, he's a prisoner, he's a foreigner. Those words go to lend the attitude of hopelessness in his life. Yet he possessed what no one else in Egypt had. He had God on his side. He was in the palm of the hand of God. Joseph was a single man whose life was submitted to God's leading. Joseph revealed God to the God of Egypt. Joseph revealed God, the real, true, one, holy, high God, to God, Pharaoh, in Egypt, little g. What does it mean to be a person whose life is submitted to God's leading? It means submitting your whole self to Him, who He is, what He says, and how He works. Is it true of you? Are you a person who is submitted to God? Because that is the kind of person that God is at work in. That is the kind of person that, despite the fact that he got chucked down in that jail and he spent 2 years from the time he talked to the cupbearer to when he was actually lifted out of the pit, that's the kind of person that stays faithful even when they don't know what God is doing. That's the kind of person that says, God has promised me that He will not abandon or forsake me or leave me alone or fill in the blank. And I'm going to live my life faithfully even though I don't know what God's timeline is. Even though I don't know what's going to happen next. Even though God could grind me into dust, I know that God is a God who resurrects. That God will make things better. That all things work together for His glory. Not mine, His. Are you submitted to Him? Do you trust Him like that? I got to tell you, that's a challenging message for me. I get mad about the silliest things. If my TiVo doesn't work properly, I'm asking God, why did you do this to me? All I wanted to do was see the game, you know? I get crazy over the silliest of things. There are bigger things that we can get worked up about. They're not little, they're actually big things, big rocks in our lives, things that are important and take up space, things that God has called us to be faithful in. Are we being submitted to God in those things? Are we submitted to Him, who He is, what He says, and how He works? Do you really believe that God is truly at work in your life to work out His will and bring glory for the kingdom of God? Not the kingdom of Chris, not the kingdom of Long Beach Alliance Church, not the kingdom of fill in your own name, but God's kingdom. That's who God is seeking. Individuals that are submitted to Him. Groups of people, communities of people that are submitted to Him. That will do what He has called us to do. Joseph is a shining example of this in the Old Testament. An example of a man who was submitted to God. And God used him. Look at letter F. Pharaoh was so impressed with Joseph's divine spirit. I see a real strong parallel to the Holy Spirit here of the New Testament. That he commanded that Joseph be the wise man that would rule over every other person in Egypt. Can you even imagine? He points at Joseph. Joseph's just giving advice. It's like, got a message from God. I am playing the conduit. Here's what God says. You should seek a wise man to oversee all of Egypt. Pharaoh picks a foreigner who clearly was on the bad end of prejudice in his country. We know that from chapter 46. And he makes him, like, vice Pharaoh over all of the country of Egypt. And Pharaoh says this amazing phrase, "You will be so powerful, the only thing that will separate you and I is the throne." That's it. All the power of this kingdom, I'm placing it in your hands. And he gives him his signet ring, a sign of authority, letter G. His clothing, he gives him a coat, a tunic. Again, this guy. Joseph was given a multicolored coat by his father. He had his coat torn away from him by Potiphar's wife. And now Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the land, puts his coat on him. And says, "This is a sign of authority for you." He places a gold necklace around his neck. It should remind us directly of Judah's story in Genesis 38. Of how Judah was condemned by these marks of his identity. And Joseph, on the flip side, is exalted by them. Judah, who tried to do things his own way, is smashed down by the identity markers of his life. Joseph, who did things God's way and submitted himself to God, is raised up by God and is exalted with these identity markers. It shows that God's justice is present in each story. That God is in control. That He has got a plan and that plan is going to be accomplished. Why? Because God is behind it. And it's true in our lives today. That God is behind the insignificant, inconsequential, meaningless circumstances of your and my life. Joseph, who woke that morning as a prisoner, is elevated to the role of prime minister, vice pharaoh of all Egypt. And in verse 43, I love this because it's good foreshadowing. Moses, fine writer. Fine writer, that man. Gives us good foreshadowing of what will happen. Pharaoh has him ride in his second chariot. He is second in the kingdom. And the people that are guiding the chariot proclaim before him, "Bow the knee before Joseph." And he set him. Joseph was set over all the land of Egypt. As the worship team comes up right now, and we come to the end of our service this morning, I'd like to just take this time. And as we sing of this morning of God's blessings in our lives, as we focus on the goodness of God, can I just call on you? Are there things that are blocking this kind of a view of God? Are there things in your life? Perhaps it's personal sin that you have allowed to creep in the doorway of your own life. And that personal sin is blocking you from living a faithful life to God because He just seems like He's at a distance. Like God is kind of blind and He doesn't really pay attention to what you're doing. But the content of this story clearly says that God is at work in the lives of His people. And while we may not see it, it is absolutely true that God's hand is at work in you and I. Have you allowed things to get in the way of your faithful living in the meantime? Have you allowed the circumstances of your life to lull and dull you into submission to this world instead of submission to God? God is seeking people who will be submitted to Him. People that will be submitted to who He is, what He says, and the way that He goes about doing it. Are you? As we sing this song, I would just ask that if God is pressing in on your heart that a change needs to be made, would you submit yourself to Him this morning? Would you ask Him to be the King in your life? Would you ask Him to take full control of who you are? Do you really believe that God is at work? Then submit your life to Him.